1929, Bryant-Denny Stadium's expansion makes it one of the largest in the Southeastern Conference. Before we head down to the field for the coin toss, we'd like to remind you this game is brought to you by Coke Zero. Real Coke taste, zero calories. Enjoy everything.
Well, you know the stadium, you've seen the ads before, and you know the conference and the colleges, and when you watch, you probably know the jersey numbers of your favorite players.
Georgia is lined up to kick the ball off first, and we are ready to go.
But listen carefully, and you'll notice something else.
Gets it. He's in space. He's at the 40. Still on his feet. He's taken down at the 32-yard line. Big game there for first down.
He's at the 40. Still on his feet. He's taken down. But who is he? The announcers are calling the game, but they are not saying the players' names. So why? This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and what you were actually listening to is sound from a video game. EA Sports NCAA Football 14, to be precise. A gaming experience that puts you in the middle of a college football game with realistic details down to the heights and weights of real-life college athletes. So fans playing the game know who those players are. The only thing missing are those actual athletes' faces and names. EA Sports launched the NCAA football video game series back in 1998, and it made the company more than $1.3 billion in sales in the United States alone. That's according to the tracking firm, the NDP Group. But the real-life athletes whose likenesses were simulated on the game? They did not get a single penny. That's because EA Sports didn't want to pay them, and more importantly, the NCAA forbid college athletes from receiving compensation for use of their name, image, or likeness. That all changed in 2014 when a U.S. district court ruled that the NCAA was violating antitrust laws in the case, so EA Sports just stopped publishing the games. It was the first hint of a massive change that was soon to come to the business of amateur college athletics. And here we are this week, and those massive changes are here. So Dennis Dodd, senior writer at CBS Sports, joins us now. Dennis, welcome to On Point. And let me just get right to the question. Given all that's happened, which we're going to talk about in a second, in the past week or so in college athletics, are we beginning to see the beginning of the end of amateurism in the NCAA?
Yes, we are. And Meghna, thanks for having me, by the way. Whatever you believe amateurism to be, and it's changed radically over the years to suit the NCAA's needs, legal and otherwise, it is essentially over. I am reading from a tweet this morning from Louisville, who is telling its athletes and its fans that players can be compensated by boosters. That would have been a violation in the past. Now it's going to be the way everyone conducts business. So yes, the NCAA has, you know, taken this to the Supreme Court, this particular case, which I know we'll get into, and they had to know this game was coming. They lost, not only lost, but were rebuked. And they are, for lack of a better term, a fly on the wall going forward in college athletics, in my opinion.
Wow. Okay, so just to put a super fine point on it, how big of a change is this to our entire conception of what amateur college athletics is supposed to be?
It's the biggest week in the history of the NCAA, which goes back 115 years. You know, it was founded on this amateur ideal. It was founded because of, physical problems and people dying in 1905, and it came to be this big brother protector of the amateur ideal. That's no longer the case. They're at the point now where not only is amateurism dead, even if they get help from outside sources like Congress or even the president in an executive order, it's going to be like an episode of Shark Tank where you sell 50% of the company. You may still own some of it, but you're not making the day-to-day decisions.
Shark Tank comes to the NCAA. Wow. Okay. So let's talk in some detail about what specifically has happened. Now, you mentioned that Supreme Court case from a handful of days ago. And a rebuke, I think, is actually even too soft a word for it. I mean, it was a smackdown, right? Like a unanimous smackdown from the high court. Remind us what happened.
Well, a week ago Monday, the Supreme Court rendered its decision in what was called the Alston case. It was NCAA versus Alston. It was a former West Virginia running back who sought, his name was on it, who sought breaking back against the NCAA's rule against limited educational benefits. And it's really strange that the NCAA chose to die on this hill, because those benefits include laptops and internships and really stuff that students can use, student athletes can use. But it chose to go to the Supreme Court on this. They'd lost in the Northern District of California. And surprisingly, in December, the Supreme Court decided to hear the case. And so when they decided 9-0 against the NCAA, not only were these educational benefits allowed in a very narrow way, by the way, the NCAA can still cap those benefits at something like $6,000 a year, but they did lose. But then it was more the decision, the 9-0 decision by the court, and the opinion written by Brett Kavanaugh, which basically said, you're running an illegal cartel, you're in violation of antitrust, and don't come before us with something like this again, because you'll be shot down. And so that created the momentum for really everything we're talking about in the last 10 days, as far as the NCAA's power going forward.
Okay. So we're going to talk about all the things that have happened, again, as you said, in the last 10 days in a second. But let me just bring in Michael McCann into the conversation. He's a professor and the founding director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire, Franklin Pierce Law, a school of law, and a legal expert at Sportico as well. Professor McCann, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's talk a little bit more about the Supreme Court and Brett Kavanaugh's decision. I mean, he basically said, per what Dennis just told us, that the NCAA was the only business that he could see whose business model was predicated on not paying its workers, because not paying its workers was the whole point. And so, I mean, was the NCAA rightly called a virtual cartel by the Supreme Court?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's important to note that that was a concurring opinion, and it wasn't the unanimous ruling by Justice Gorsuch. So it doesn't have the same force of law. It's certainly influential. I don't know how some of the other justices feel about that. And I think we saw back in March during the oral argument, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Breyer, all expressed some reticence, with regard to a broader critique of the NCAA. So it's interesting, as Dennis noted, the case was confined to education-related benefits. Had it been a broader case, we may have seen a very different outcome. And maybe one day we'll find out. We know where Justice Kavanaugh stands, but we don't know about the other eight.
So tell us, why do you think the NCAA, I think Dennis put it right, decided that this was the hill it was going to die on? It was going to drive it all the way to the Supreme Court when we're talking about limited educational benefits.
I think the NCAA clearly miscalculated, but they miscalculated for a reason that might be somewhat rational. They thought that a 1984 Supreme Court decision called Board of Regents, which did not involve college athletes, it involved broadcasting rights and the NCAA's ability to suppress them, which they actually lost the case, incidentally. But within that case, Justice Stevens wrote very glowingly about the ability of the NCAA to govern student-athlete issues. And the NCAA has consistently invoked that language. So I assume they thought, we can get the Ninth Circuit to reverse on this. And the NCAA would also argue that education-related benefits is an ambiguous term. Mm-hmm. And it could mean a lot of things that might be only loosely connected to education. Justice Gorsuch wrote, you can't allow Lamborghinis but maybe something less than that. And it remains to be seen how that language will be interpreted. So I think the NCAA had some genuine concerns about that language.
You can't allow Lamborghinis. Okay. But the NCAA did release a statement, right? And they actually, in their statement, have said that the ruling reaffirms the NCAA's authority to adopt reasonable rules and repeatedly notes that the NCAA remains free to articulate what are and are not truly educational benefits.
Sure. So in a technical sense, that's accurate. I think in a more realistic sense, I'm a little less certain. And I say that because the Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch made clear that the Board of Regents case, that 1984 case, is no longer good law for purposes of regulating college athletes. That's a big defeat to the NCAA, because that means what it is traditionally construed as deference under antitrust law is out the window. We don't know how the court would rule on issues of athletic-related expenses. Well, maybe we'll find out one day. That's an open question. So I don't think the NCAA is, in a technical sense, correct. The court didn't address that. And the court also noted that the NCAA can use reasonable rules, but that's just simply antitrust law. Under antitrust law, competing businesses can join hands in ways that are reasonable. What the NCAA didn't do here was come up with reasonable rules because they lost 9-0.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, we could talk a lot more about the Supreme Court case, but because it's limited to, you know, what is loosely defined as educational benefits, that's only really part of the picture. I'm going to turn back to you, Dennis, here. We just got about a minute to go before our first break. Really, the bigger story is that, as you said, in the past several days, like, the floodgates have been opened for massive amounts of money overall that college athletes could potentially benefit from. That they simply had no access to before. So actually, you know what? We got to the break here. So I'm going to just, instead of cutting you off, I'm going to take us to the break and we'll pick up that point when we come back. So we are talking about whether or not we are at the cusp or even past the point where amateurism in college athletics is over. Dennis Dodd joins us. He's a senior writer at CBS Sports, and Michael McCann is with us as well, president and founding director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at University of New Hampshire. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about whether amateurism is over when it comes to college athletics, not just because of the recent major Supreme Court ruling against the NCAA, but bigger changes when it comes to the NCAA's own rules and laws in at least seven states. And we're getting a lot of feedback on Facebook from On Point and sports fans. We're, by the way, we're at On Point Radio on Twitter and Facebook. Darren Helwedge says, being a big sports guy, my opinion is this is a big change, but one that'll be figured out. College athletics is too much a part of the American and campus culture. It will evolve but not end. Whereas Chris Tucker says, get sports out of the university altogether, and the problem is completely solved. I'm joined today by Michael McCann. He's a professor and the founding director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire. And Dennis Dodd is with us as well. He's a senior writer for CBS Sports. So let's talk about where the big money might come in, Dennis, here for a second. On July 1st, so tomorrow, seven states are set to enact or begin laws that will allow athletes to profit from the use of their name, image, or likeness. So essentially, they can make money off those rights. The NCAA has also just recommended on Monday something similar. So can you explain to us what's going on there?
Yeah, that number is actually up to 14, at least through Tuesday. There was a rash of governors who took action, or state houses. in that sense, it's become competition almost. The majority of these states are in the South and the SEC, and they see this as some sort of recruiting advantage. I would submit that right now, states without laws have the advantage because the NCAA has stepped aside and not changed its rules, but waived its rules. It has no NIL rules except for very small regulations that it can't be for pay for play. And I would argue that's been happening for years in small ways. Bowl gifts are, even though capped at $550, are nothing more than rewards for playing football. I would argue that cost of attendance, which has been around for about 4 or 5 years, goes to athletes only because they're athletes. But we can have that discussion another day. Yeah, it's going to happen. The NCAA this week was in the process, again, of waiving those rules. They did it strategically to avoid legal liability. It's going to be done by the board of directors. And everything is on the table. I'm personally aware of $500,000 deals that will debut. Some of them I've written about, some of them anecdotally I just know of. There's a pair of twins at Fresno State, basketball players, women's basketball players, who are valued for their social alone at $500,000. I read this week on Twitter that that known source, there's a $1 million contract out there. There's rumors of a Power Five quarterback getting a national deal, whether it's a commercial endorsement or whatever. Everything's going to be on the table. And as you alluded to, I think, or one of the listeners did, I think this is going to work its way out. This may be a discussion for later in the hour, but the sky is not falling. I think, I don't know if Michael agrees, but I think most of us just want to see the games.
Yeah.
And none of this is going to spoil the fact is going to keep the shoe or the big house from being filled for Ohio State, Michigan. They just want to see the games. And so after a period of upheaval, I think we'll get back to that.
So I mean, what you're saying is like fans don't care. They want to watch the sports. Like
I think they care. I think they care to the point that I boil it down this way. What is the number figure? What is the amount of money that turns off fans and keeps them from A, going to games, and B, watching? And I would submit that's almost an unlimited number. Because if you're Justin Fields and you can lead Ohio State to a Big Ten title, who cares if you're making $200,000 from an endorsement deal? I mean, at least to those fans. And I've talked to athletes about what happens the first time, you know, you have a bad game and you're making most of the money. Well, that happens now. They're getting destroyed on social media.
Yeah.
And it's really brutal, but they'll have to get over it.
I mean, I think we know the answer to the question, right? Because all you have to do is look at the professional leagues. There's an unlimited amount of money that can get paid, and people still, I mean, granted, I guess it's like, that's the whole amateurism debate, but people will watch because they love the game. I mean, Michael, jump in here. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with Dennis completely. I don't think this is going to turn off fans. And this has been a problem for the NCAA in some of these litigations, is where they have survey data saying fans would be worried if players are paid. But the problem with that data set is that it alludes to players being paid by their schools as some sort of salary. Mm-hmm. That's not what this is about. This is about, as Dennis explained, this is about third-party endorsements. This is Justin Fields signing with a sneaker company or whatever it may be. The school isn't the payer. And I also think, as Dennis sort of, the NCAA has tried to diminish its liability by having this not be done by the NCAA itself, but by its subsidiaries, including member schools. But it could still get in trouble legally, because there's another case going on called House versus NCAA, which very basically is this. It's the argument that, hey, why weren't we paid name, image, and likeness all these years?
Yeah.
And now suddenly it's okay under amateurism to allow it. That's going to be a compelling argument for the lawyers.
Okay. I want to take a step back here, because we're sort of kicking around this amateurism phrase. And I just want to take a few minutes to explore why it has been so central for a century, as Dennis, you were saying earlier, to the concept, our sort of high-minded concept of what college athletics is supposed to be. So let's actually just listen to some pushback here. This is from former NFL quarterback Tim Tebow. Back in 2019, he was on ESPN talking about why he believes college athletes should not be paid.
Well, then it just becomes the NFL. Now it's just who has the most money, who's going to pay them the most. And I think you take a lot of the authenticity and the realness in college football away. And are there people doing things that are illegal? Of course. But we're not going to set the standard for the people that are doing it the wrong way. We're going to set the standard for the people that are doing it the right way.
Michael McCann, where did this idea of amateurism, meaning you don't get paid to do this, where did it come from for the NCAA and why did it become so central?
Sure, I'll answer that in a second. I think Tim Tebow's conflating things there. Okay. I think he's conflating being paid by a school and what we've been talking about, which is relationships with companies outside of the school. But in terms of where this comes from, amateurism is a relic of an era that's no longer here. When the NCAA was formed in the early 20th century, it was designed to focus on player safety. It had nothing to do with compensation issues. That only came up 50 years later, and specifically in response to concerns that college athletes were seeking recovery under workers' comp statutes. So schools said, wait a second, you're not employees, you're student athletes. It was a litigation vehicle more than anything else. Now, it's taken on a broader meaning, maybe romanticized meaning, but it's the idea that if college athletes are paid, they're somehow no longer college athletes. They're no longer amateurs. And as a result, the NCAA has argued fans will lose interest, that fans will view them as minor league players, sort of inferior to the pros. This will hurt everyone. This will hurt the schools. It's sort of a sob story that courts haven't bought, frankly. And also, it misses the point, misses the detail as to what we're talking about with these payments. They're very different, an endorsement deal versus being paid by a school.
Okay, so just to be clear, to keep the legal rulings in mind here, or not just the legal rulings, but the rules changes from the NCAA. We talked about, yes, athletes may be able to receive endorsement deals now, but are colleges going to be allowed to pay athletes, per your point about the difference there?
They'll be able to compensate them for education-related expenses.
Per the Supreme Court. Okay.
Per the Supreme Court. And what that phrase means, we'll have to figure out over time.
Okay. But then in addition, but they won't be able to pay them a salary.
Correct.
But they can, right, they can receive endorsement deals from third parties, essentially.
That's right. Now, there are other changes that could come up. I think we know that Northwestern football players about 8 years ago tried to be declared employees with the idea that they would then be able to form a union. That's a more complicated topic because labor laws, private schools is governed by federal law, at state schools is governed by the laws of the state. They vary, as we know, the ability to unionize varies by state. So that's a more complicated topic that's not going to be resolved through Alston.
Okay. I should know this, Dennis, and so forgive me if I don't, but how can we even sort of wrap our heads around about how much money, how big is the money game in the NCAA, in college sports overall? I don't even know how we quantify that.
In currently or what they can get?
Yeah, no, currently, right now.
Oh, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And football is on an order of, five times more than basketball. As big as basketball is in the tournament, football drives the bus. And that's what it's become. You can draw a direct line from Board of Regents, which Michael mentioned, to the Supreme Court decision. Board of Regents deregulated college football television and created a pot of money that over time became so unregulated that it drew the interest of the lawyers for the purpose of them making their fees. I mean, that's as simple as I can boil it down. There's a money enough out there to sue over because the athletes weren't getting enough. And I say enough because there's another fallacy. They are getting paid and they are getting, I wouldn't call it compensation. It's money they can get. There's a long snapper at LSU who told me, he's in the NFL now, who told me he'd saved from getting $40,000 plus over his career from cost of attendance, from various grants, from scholarship checks, that he was able to save. Nobody talks about how did that ruin the amateur ideal? Mm. Again, that came from the university. That came from the federal government. None of the NIL does. I had an SEC coach tell me once that he did the math for me. Our players can make $96,000 if they over 4 years, if X happens, and there was a lot that had to happen, and it was all legal. So for this, and I'll give one more example. The NCAA over the years have given over 200 waivers that have allowed NIL. They don't want you to know about it because the cases, I'm told by one source, are hidden away. Schools can access them. The public can't see them. You or I can see them. But I know of one case 4 years ago where Joe Montana was in a commercial for California Tourism, one of those come to California. Mm-hmm. He was on the screen for about 5 seconds. In that 5 seconds, he threw a pass to a person you barely notice. I don't think he even appears, his face appears on camera. He was a Division I baseball player who was at a park that day to see Joe Montana filming. None of the actors around Joe Montana could catch a pass. He volunteered, had to sign some sort of SAG waiver, you know, Screen Actors Guild thing. The commercial was seen internationally. He made $50,000 in residuals and was declared permanently ineligible by the NCAA. Again, appeared on the screen less than a second. He hired a lawyer. The lawyer got him his eligibility back, and eventually he was able to keep the money. But the NCAA doesn't want you to know that. This has been going on.
Just for catching a pass, although I have to say catching a pass from Joe Montana seems right. like a life highlight.
You can Google it. It's out there. Just do Joe Montana and California Tourism. You will see the commercial.
So the point is that the NCAA has been making exceptions for a long time. They just don't, as you said, they just
Absolutely.
Don't want people to know.
Absolutely.
But I do want to hear from both of you, because Michael, you had mentioned that maybe the romanticized notion of amateur athletics. I think we heard that a little bit in the Tim Tebow cut, right? Because he talked about taking away the authenticity and realness of college football if money enters the game. I mean, is that just Tim Tebow, or is there a critical mass of folks out there who still feel that?
There may very well be a critical mass of folks out there who still feel that. But the problem is that the money's already here. It's been here for decades. It just hasn't gone to the athlete. That's really the central, that was the central point in Alston case when it began, which is schools are spending a ton of money, be it on coaches, being on staff, stadiums, arenas, facilities that rival pro teams, but they couldn't pay that money to athletes who they're trying to recruit. So this and that was the argument that ultimately persuaded the court. So I teach undergrad students, and I'm normally a law professor and I teach law school, but every year I teach one undergrad course, and I have student athletes in that course. They are students before they're athletes. They're not going pro. They are there at UNH to study, and they play a sport as well, and they take both really seriously. I think that's a great model. I think the difficulty with college sports is that it's so across the spectrum how college sports occurs, where big-time college football has so much money gravitating towards it, or in men's basketball, where players might stay 1 year. And really, if you think about it, if they're staying 1 year, what is their educational experience? They go to class in the fall semester and then leave in the middle of the spring? I mean, is that really what college should be about? I think these are harder questions that go well beyond the Alston case or NIL.
Now, again, just to be clear, when we talked about the NCAA's Division I Council making this recommendation that athletes be allowed to profit from their name, image, and likeness rights, is that only applicable to Division I? What about the other divisions?
Right now it's Division I, but I think it's worth noting that cheerleaders have been able to benefit from NIL. Esports players have been able to benefit from NIL. Musicians, actors have all been able to enjoy the benefit of the right of publicity. And that really goes to a central point. As Americans, we all have a right of publicity. It's what college athletes also have that right, but it's been NCAA rules that suppress that right. I would look at it that way.
Mm. Dennis, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I call it the Gerber baby syndrome. You know, the Gerber baby, the parents or that person capitalized on what you're given at birth. You own the rights to yourself, your brand. That family or that kid has gotten money from that company for years, I would suspect. There's a I should also mention the NAIA, the small college division, adopted NIL rules last October. And it was much easier because there was much less money in the NAIA. But there's some interesting things going on there. There's a woman football player, by the way, at Central Methodist University in Missouri, who already has made a Super Bowl commercial. Toyota featured her in a Super Bowl commercial because she had played football at the junior college level, had beaten cancer. Not a huge national story, but it was known, and she'd made a lot of money, had a marketing agent. And the NIL at the time, before it changed its rules, simply said, well, this is too good of a story. We're just going to suspend our rules. This is great for her.
Well, we are talking today about the massive changes. Dennis Dodd calls it the biggest change to happen to the NCAA in a century when it comes to players being allowed to profit from the use of their name, image, and likeness. We will have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I want to give you a glimpse about what we're going to talk about tomorrow on the show. We will be talking about Britney Spears and her battle to take back control of her finances and her life and what her story tells us about conservatorships, where a court orders a family member, a lawyer, or someone else to take over an incapacitated or otherwise disabled person's financial affairs. Now, we want to hear from folks out there. If you or someone you know has ever been placed under a conservatorship or you were appointed a conservator, we'd love to hear your story. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We want to hear what the experience has been like for you, whether the system worked and was a lifesaver, or if you see it as one ripe for abuse. We're going to be talking about conservatorships tomorrow. Today, we are talking about the massive sea change in rules with the NCAA when it comes to athletes being able to profit from the use of their name, image, or likeness. Also, a major Supreme Court ruling that said that the NCAA cannot bar schools from making limited educational compensation or giving limited educational compensation to athletes. So we're just talking about the major change in the business of college athletics, getting a lot of response here on Twitter. Lisa Gardner says, beginning? No, the beginning happened decades ago under the table payments. Making it legal or acceptable is better for athletes. They can now negotiate better deals, i.e., Rich You offered me $50,000 in cash per year plus a $50,000 bonus if I hit these scoring goals. What will you do for me? Lisa Harkey says amateurism died when sports became profit centers for schools. Multi-million dollar salaries for coaches and assistant coaches and trainers from exploiting unpaid athletes is not amateurism. It is, at best, indentured servitude. Actually, Michael McCann, respond to that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the restraints on opportunity, economic opportunity, is certainly troubling. And it's been that way for a long time. Now, whether I would say it's indentured servitude, I mean, that's a strong choice of words.
On Twitter, never.
So I don't think I would go there. And I wouldn't go there more specifically because certainly it's the option of a student to play a sport and to go to a school to play a sport. he or she doesn't have to do that. And I would add that there are other types of scholarships that they could pursue, academic, whatever they may be. Also, let's be honest, for those that get a full ride to college, that's a lot of money. I mean, college is so much money these days. To get a full ride and room and board, for some, it's a really good opportunity. I think for others, there's no reason to deny them additional benefit, be it education-related benefits or name, image, and likeness. That's how I would look at it.
Okay. You know, I want to actually hear, Dennis, from you, another example of how athletes have had to navigate or go around the rules before this week, essentially, because we've been focusing a lot on, you know, the big money sports, football, basketball, et cetera. But the NCAA's rules have had an across-the-board effect on other athletes, including really big name ones like Katie Ledecky. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Can you tell us that story about what she's had to
do? Yeah, it's a shame because of athletes like her. Katie Ledecky is arguably this country's most decorated Olympic swimmer and maybe greatest swimmer of all time. She was forced to give up her Stanford scholarship because she needed to earn money to train and was getting offers to do commercials and the stuff we're talking about right now. And it was a darn shame, a damn shame at the time, because of these outdated rules. She couldn't do this. She's an Olympic swimmer. She's balancing a Stanford education, and she can't make a few bucks for her, for her name, image, and likeness, which the Olympic model for about 33 years has allowed athletes to do. And I think that's where we're headed, with the NCAA. There have been other examples. There was a swimmer at Texas who won a medal from, I want to say, Syria. And I forget his name. I've written about him. Well, his country, because he brought glory to his country, gave him an award worth $736,000. And I think in that situation, he was able to keep it because it came from his country. But, you know, again, what are we talking about? Jeremy Bloom, the former football player and skier at Colorado, was forced to give up football because he wanted to earn money, again, to train to be an Olympic skier. And he's gone on to be an activist and an advocate and do documentaries about this and deserves a lot of credit for where we are today. But again, it's things like that I think turn the tide. Yeah. You know, when you talk about a free scholarship, real quickly, I always say that it's not free because in all divisions, there was a Pac-12 study done a few years ago that said that athletes work 50 hours a week on their chosen sport. That's before they crack a book to study. And legislation, Magna, actually had to be put in that no practice could start after midnight or before 6 a.m. You know what that meant? Somebody was doing that. Some coach was doing that. So that's where we're at. It's not free.
Wow. Okay. And the Katie Ledecky story is just really eye-opening because, to be clear, I think she had endorsement deals, like you said, but she couldn't take them for a couple of years. And then in order to be able to earn the money to pay for her Olympic training, she ultimately had to leave Stanford after a couple of years. So she really had to exchange her Stanford education for an opportunity to train and make money to be an American Olympian. That is remarkable. I don't even think that's the right word. I don't quite know else how to describe it. Now, we actually talked to an athlete about what she thinks regarding these major changes that are happening in college athletics. And her name is Margzetta Frazier. She's a rising senior on the UCLA gymnastics team. She competed for the U.S. women's national team in 2017 and 2018. And here's what she says the NCAA's waiver of those NIL rules mean for her.
I had gymnastics companies reach out to me, leotard companies asking me since eighth grade, seventh grade, offering to give me free Leos to wear, which I had to, of course, say no, because then I would not be able to be a collegiate athlete.
Of course, that was only the beginning. The NCAA rules have continued to limit Frazier from endorsement opportunities throughout her collegiate career, but with a couple of exceptions. For example, Frazier was speaking to us at Woodward West, where right now she's currently helping run the gymnastics camp.
You really got to walk on eggshells. Like, yes, I can get paid for this camp, but this camp cannot post me on their social media and say, hey, Marzetta Frazier is going to be here. Please sign up for our camp. And I can't post and say, hey, I'm going to Woodward. Everybody come to Woodward.
By the way, just to be clear, Marzetta is at Woodward as a camp counselor being paid as an employee. So that's why she said she has to walk on eggshells about this, because she also has this bigger life as a well-known gymnast. And more importantly, per NCAA compliance rules, the former U.S. national team gymnast would be paid not on the basis of her athletic reputation, but as I said, the going rate for camp or clinic counselors. And for most college athletes, including Frazier, there's another reason these limitations really do matter. Unlike basketball or football, most collegiate sports do not have professional leagues that athletes can move on to, meaning that college may be when these athletes hit their peak name, image, and likeness value.
When you think about your career coming to your last 4 years, it's just hard to know in your gut that you're not going to make anything from all of your hard work. And of course, you have the titles that no one can ever take away from you. But I remember winning bars at the World Cup and getting the silver medal in Birmingham, England. And I believe I won like 11,000 pounds. And I don't know where any of it is. So it sucks to think about, because you watch your football friends be millionaires and you're just like, oh, well, this is fun.
And Marzetta says the reality hits even harder because with over 400,000 combined followers on Instagram and TikTok, she has the kind of social media presence right now that marketing companies crave. But despite missing the opportunity during her first 3 years in college, and as you heard her say earlier, really since middle school, she says that waiving NIL rules has the potential still to impact her life beyond her collegiate career.
My dream has always been to be in entertainment. And so I am working on music, and I have been thinking about managers, and I could not reach out to anyone legally to even ask questions, because that can be considered an NCAA violation. I could not get beats from producers, because that's also a violation. I couldn't even really collab with people. So now that these rules are being lifted, I can do my craft how I want to do it, get the professional help I need, and post it and just see how it goes. And I just feel like figuring this out while I have the support of my friends and my team and my family all in one spot would be so much easier to do than scattering after college trying to figure everything out.
That's Marzetta Frazier, rising senior on the UCLA gymnastics team, and also she competed for the United States women's national team in 2017 and 2018. So Michael McCann, what do you think some of the long-term post-college impacts might be here, as Marzetta has described?
Well, and Marzetta really captured it so well to be able to provide her own story that illustrates the things that we've been talking about. I think what we're looking at is someone like Marzetta, starting July 1, will have a whole new set of opportunities that she's been denied for years, and other athletes in her position have been denied. That will mean endorsement deals, but it will also mean the things that she referenced, such as sponsoring a camp, getting money to do that. Maybe it's not becoming rich. And as she noted, the chance to make money for one's publicity rights while in college is while in college for most. Most are not going to the NBA or NFL or WNBA or some other leagues. This is their moment. This is their chance. And they're no longer going to be denied it. But there's a legal piece to this as well. Marzetta and others, if the House versus NCAA case is certified as a class action, they'll be able to join that case or other cases and seek money for the money for all this time when they could have had NIL but didn't have it.
That seems like it could potentially be a huge amount of money.
Oh, yeah. We're talking potentially, if it's certified as a class, billions of dollars, because the class goes to 2016. So everyone in college that could have been making money in NIL since 2016 through the end of the case, which could be who knows when, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. It's a huge number of people that could join that case and benefit. It's early, so we'll see, but that's a case to keep an eye out on.
You know, I think I use superlatives too often, but here's a case where it's really justified. I mean, huge is the word for the change and the potential ongoing impact. Now, listen, we spoke with Jason Belzer. He's a sports attorney and founder of Athletic Director U. And we asked him, so how much college athletes could potentially make off their name, image, and likeness?
I would project that the most valuable athletes may exceed, you know, high six figures, maybe low seven figures, but it's unlikely that you're going to have a substantial amount of athletes making more than $500,000 a year. We're talking about the clear-cut Zion Williamsons and Trevor Lawrences of the world, like surefire number one picks in the NBA or the NFL draft.
Okay, but he also told us about a surprising finding in his projections.
We project that the average female student athlete will make more than the average male athlete. So when we're talking about equity and all of this, this is NIL is actually hopefully going to be more advantageous to women than it is to men. The projection comes from that the average female student athlete as compared to male student athlete has a larger social following.
That's Jason Belzer, sports attorney and founder of Athletic Director U. And, you know, as we heard just a minute ago, Mark Zetter-Frazier has 400,000 combined followers on social media. Dennis Dodd, what do you think about this idea that female athletes might actually, on average, benefit more from this than men?
Yeah, that's the first I've heard of that. But I have become enlightened to the fact long ago that this is going to be a huge boon to female athletes, you know, because of the opportunities they're going to have. Not only in the athletic realm, you talked about the gymnast. There's going to be modeling opportunities for male and female, but this is something that was you know, frowned upon and not legal in NCAA's eyes. And who knows how far that goes? The twins at the, I mentioned the twins at Fresno State. Part of that is going to be their appeal. They're a heck of a basketball players, but they're kind of a package. They're twins. They're great. They're going to be able to do things that were illegal before. So I haven't written about it a lot. I have made reference to it because I haven't, to my detriment, have not dived down a lot. But yes, this is going to be huge for female athletes.
Well, I mean, to your detriment now, but opportunity abounds, Dennis. So,
yes.
So we're always looking forward here. Michael McCann, I want to get your quick sense about this is a temporary measure from the NCAA about those NIL rules. But once the money enters the picture, I mean, do you expect the NCAA ever to go back? Or are we really at the beginning of a new era?
Yeah, we're at the beginning of a new era. I don't think you can unwind this once it starts. It will take momentum and spiral in the direction that it's going to go into. I think one question will be, will Congress get involved? We know that Congress has explored a federal NIL statute. They weren't able to get that done by July 1st. Perhaps if this turns out to be a chaotic period, the ideal for having a federal law that ensures that every athlete in every state plays by the same set of rules, regardless of a school as well, maybe we would see that kind of activity. That's the only kind of change I could see. I don't see the NCAA unwinding this.
Yeah. You know, one thing I'm curious about is whenever you have billions of dollars at play, there will always be unintended consequences, right? So something I'm thinking about is watching what happens with, say, high school and middle school athletes, and maybe we'll see a whole new set of pressures on them. But we'll keep our eye on that. Michael McCann, professor and the founding director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dennis Dodd, senior writer at CBS Sports. Dennis, it was great to have you. Thank you so very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.